I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
When was the last time you were mad as heck? How do you express your anger, or do you try to control or suppress it? Do you think anger is a bad emotion, even a dangerous one? We will talk with a guest this hour who says anger is a misunderstood emotion, and he has come up with five things you should know about anger. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September the 26th. I'm not angry this morning. I'm happy to be back after attending a work conference last week, and I'm looking forward to your questions and stories about anger and the upside or benefits of anger. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Ryan Martin. He's an anger researcher and chair of the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. His piece on anger appeared last week on the Psychology Today website, and we have linked that piece to our website and Facebook page. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how did you start researching anger as a main research topic?
Well, it started when I was an undergraduate student living in the Twin Cities, and I worked at a shelter for adolescents, and one of the things I saw over and over and over again was how anger seemed to be kind of causing problems, or a lack or difficulty controlling anger seemed to be causing problems for a lot of the kids there.
Mm-hmm.
Went on to graduate school at University of Southern Mississippi and worked with a really great researcher, and great friend named Eric Dahlin, and the two of us started studying anger more thoroughly there. So, it really stemmed from my kind of recognizing this as a real problem in a lot of young kids.
Yeah, but you say it's a frequently misunderstood emotion. Why do you say that?
Yeah, in fact, one of the things I realized when I really started studying it is that my understanding of anger was flawed. That ultimately, I think, more often than not, people kind of confuse anger and aggression. And now aggression being a behavior and anger being an emotion. And specifically aggression being a behavior about harming someone or something. Anger being the emotion we feel when we've been wronged. A lot of times people will, you know, when they're angry, they become aggressive. That's no secret. But I think part of what we see is that often, in fact, more often, I think, when people get angry, they don't act aggressively. They engage in all sorts of other sorts of behaviors to try and deal with that anger.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your piece, The Five Things to Know About Anger, that was the first thing. Anger is different from aggression.
Absolutely.
And the second thing was people get angry under fairly predictable circumstances.
Yeah, when you look at the situations that make people angry, as a general rule, you see that it's situations that are unpleasant. They're situations that the person perceives as unfair. Where they identify, oftentimes another person who they think is to blame, and so forth. So the situations, with regard to how we interpret the situations, are fairly predictable. The difference, then, between why two people might respond to the same situation, one with anger and one with a different emotion, has to do with how they interpret those situations.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I can understand that. Anger is not inherently bad.
No, I don't think so. If you in fact, I would argue that no emotions are inherently bad, that they actually all are inherently good, that just like, you know, fear may motivate us to protect ourselves from danger, anger motivates us to confront an injustice. If someone has wronged us, anger motivates us to confront that injustice and to do something about it. It also energizes us to confront that injustice. You know, I'm certain that people have had an experience where they have, maybe they were kind of exhausted, but they see something or something goes wrong, they get angry about it, and all of a sudden they've got this renewed energy to try and deal with whatever that problem was. And then the big issue is, well, how do you deal with it? And there are all sorts of productive ways that you can handle that anger and channel it into something positive.
And some of those productive ways?
I tend to think that problem solving in particular and including sort of appropriate assertiveness rather than aggressive responses, I think that typically when you're feeling angry, it means that there's some sort of problem. And the best way to handle that is not to not get mad about it. That's going to be futile, but to try and channel that anger into trying to solve whatever that problem is, to talk to the person who may have wronged you, or to solve whatever. A lot of times we're getting angry at inanimate objects, right? The TV is not working, the computer won't print, things like that. trying to find a way to solve whatever those problems are is going to be a lot healthier than hitting the computer or hitting the TV or just complaining about it.
I giggled because this morning I was trying to print something off at home and my ink cartridge was out of ink. I did not push the computer off the table, though. But
right.
What I did is I came in to work a little bit earlier than I might have to use the printer at work.
Right.
That being said, that the anger can cause a variety of problems for people. It's not all good.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a really important point. I don't want to come across sounding as though, hey, anger is this great thing and people just need to embrace it. That's not the point. Anger does cause problems for people. It causes lots of problems. And actually, one of the things I argue in the piece is that that people probably need to be more aware of the scope of those problems, that sometimes it's damaged relationships, sometimes it's, physical or verbal fights. But there are also, and those are the ones that are really well known to people, but in addition to that, there are, the unintentional self-injury. The person who gets so angry that they, put their hand through a window and cut their arm up. The person who, gets so upset at the football game that they throw the remote at the TV and break the TV. So property damage is another example. Health consequences. We know that anger is associated with various cardiovascular disorders and other sorts of health problems. We also have some evidence that says that people who are angry don't recover as quickly from illnesses, that they tend to alienate their social support network and so forth.
But what's your interpretation of the that famous scene in Network that I played when I first started the program, where the character whips open the window and he tries to tell everyone, "Shout out! I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore."
This is mildly embarrassing, but I have not actually seen that movie.
Oh, really?
I know. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar. Well, I'm familiar with the line, but never actually mm-hmm. known the context.
But in part, yeah, he was telling people to not just sit back and take it, that you can right the wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really good point. And I think that, one of the things I try to point out to people when we talk about this is that anger has been a motivator for all sorts of great political movements. We've seen just in Wisconsin in the last year, we've seen a lot of angry, mostly state employees, but certainly others who have used that anger to motivate themselves. What makes that such a good example is that we didn't necessarily see aggressive responses to that. We saw a lot of problem solving, people trying to right the wrong.
We are talking with Ryan Martin. He's an anger researcher. He's chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. And we are talking with him about his piece on anger that appeared last week on the Psychology Today website. It's on 5 things you should know about anger. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions, maybe your own stories. Do you think of anger as a negative emotion, or do you see an upside to it? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be a cloudy day today, but breaking up somewhat in the afternoon. Otherwise breezy with a chance of showers and isolated storms, with highs ranging from the upper 50s in southwestern Wisconsin to the mid-60s in the Northwoods. Well, that's a change. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 19 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September the 26th. Coming up in our state capitol report after 7 o'clock, the school voucher issue has brought a lot of money into political campaigns in Wisconsin. And according to our guest, after 7, we will talk about whether donors, campaign donors, are getting paid back in terms of policy, educational policy. That's coming up in our state capitol report after 7 o'clock. Right now, we are talking about anger and some things you should know about anger with Ryan Martin. He is an anger researcher and chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. And we are talking about the downside of anger, but also the possible benefits. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones. Brian in Milwaukee joins us first. Hello, Brian.
Yes, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Wisconsin. And good morning, Dr. Ryan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I'm not angry.
Good. I'm glad.
I do want to point out that anger is a secondary emotion. The primary emotion is fear of loss. We have two primary motivators we make any decision. That's hope for gain and fear of loss. People get angry when they think they're going to lose something. The other thing I think important is that anger is a survival mechanism, something that we've evolved with over many, many, many millennia, and it has served to protect us from the onslaught of significant loss. Mm-hmm. So perhaps, you know, cognitively people can help to understand their anger and look inward and find out what it is they're afraid of. That may help manage that part of it. Mm-hmm. And another part is being an emotion. They may be able to use other constructs, visualizations, to reframe their situation and divert their anger. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Completely agree with the second point. I'm, in fact, Darwin himself, wrote about witnessing kind of. It's hard because when you start talking about animals, you immediately have to start talking about behavior. So you start talking about aggression. But Darwin himself acknowledged kind of the importance of anger and aggression as an evolutionary survival mechanism. With regard to the first point about it being a secondary emotion, I think that is true some of the time, and it has to be. It's in many ways kind of context specific, and it is an argument many people make, and there are many other researchers who would argue that anger is a secondary emotion, using the same lines that you made. That as a general rule, you know, if you feel if you fear you're going to lose something, then you would experience fear. If you have lost something, you should experience sadness. People, however, respond with anger to both those things, arguing that, well, maybe anger kind of comes along after the fact. And that's certainly a valid argument.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that we should ask ourselves what we are afraid of in order to deal with our anger.
No, I mean, I guess what I think is whenever people are experiencing a strong emotion, no matter what it is, it's in their best interest to evaluate why and to think about what's going on, why they might be feeling that way. And I think usually when that happens, you can come to some important conclusions about what's the best way to handle it.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of where we might experience anger when we are not experiencing fear of loss?
I think a lot of times, what I think is happening is that maybe at this under, and I think, you know, grief is probably a really good example of this. You know, a person who loses a loved one, most, you know, grief specialists would say that part of that process is some anger towards the deceased. That is part of the grieving experience. But I think ultimately that's motivated more by this hurt that the person is experiencing, and not so much that they're actually angry at the person. That in that case, it really is a secondary emotion after the sadness that they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. When Brian mentioned that when we're feeling this anger, we should, reframe the issues, what does that mean, or what should we do when we feel that anger coming on?
Well, I think reframing is an important tool, and what that means is basically try and think about this situation in a different way, and think about, well, is there a way in which this is positive? You know, and so an example of that, let's say, you know, as people often become angry at the weather, you know, because the weather ruined their plans for the day. Reframing would be to think about all the ways in which maybe the rain is a positive. You know, well, it's good for the crops or that sort of thing. And we, you know, that kind of, well, we needed the rain, so it's not all that bad. That's reframing, is thinking about this thing in a new light and a new interpretation.
And what should we think about that driver who cut us off in traffic?
See, that is, I was going to say, sometimes anger is a totally reasonable emotion. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that reframing is always the best thing to do. I think that sometimes the interpretation you have is the correct one. But I think that you also need to think about, well, what's the best way to handle it? What do I do about the driver and who cut me off? Do I chase after him? You know, that's probably not the healthiest thing. Do I let it go? You know, and in fact, what I usually do in those situations is say, I'm not sure I trust that guy. I'm going to keep my distance. Because that's, you know, in my mind, the safest, smartest thing to do.
Is it okay if I, you know, want to express, you know, I don't know, my dissatisfaction with that driver in the privacy of my own car just by, you know, letting a few choice words fly? I mean, is that good for me to do that?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's good for you. I wouldn't say it's bad for you either. I think a situation like that, you know, doesn't necessarily do any harm and is perfectly safe. The one thing what we're sort of alluding to is this notion of catharsis, this idea that, you know, well, we got to let off steam in some way. And that's actually one of the, in fact, if I was to add a sixth thing to my list here of things people should know, it's that, as a general rule, catharsis doesn't work.
Oh, too bad.
And yes, it's something that's really surprising. I mean, people have been talking about catharsis since Plato. And so, as a treatment tool, and people still embrace that. However, we know that, like anything, you know, practice makes perfect. And if we get used to dealing with anger always by punching a pillow or by, you know, swearing and yelling and things like that, then that's going to be our default when situations arise.
More callers. Marvin in Phillips is with us. Hello, Marvin.
Oh, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Professor.
Morning.
It's kind of funny how you're talking about anger today, because it was Sunday Comics yesterday, and Beetle Bailey, the general, was trying to get his laptop to work, and he ended up throwing it in the trash can, shooting it with his revolver.
Oh my gosh!
But when I was growing up in the eastern part of the country, there was a gentleman farmer next door who was notoriously angry. I remember one time he was trying to put a starter in his tractor, and it wasn't cooperating, and he finally threw the starter down the canal and then yelled at his son and screamed at him and made him go down there and get it out of the canal. And that was just kind of the way he lived. And he ended up, none of his boys wanted to take over the farm. And he ended up a sad old man all by himself.
Yeah. Well, that's very, you know, that is sad, Marvin. Thanks for sharing that story. It does bring up, you know, are some people, you know, I don't know, perpetually angry? And can you talk a little bit about the biology of anger and why some people react differently than others?
Yeah, we a couple things. I guess to answer your question, yes, there are some people who are more likely to get angry and who are just kind of angry a lot and have a short fuse and so forth. Some of that seems to be the biology. We've got some evidence that says that testosterone is related to both anger and aggression. And so some of that is there. We also have, there's some evidence that says that, you know, some of the same neurotransmitters that are involved with other emotions, like sadness and fear, are associated with anger. So there's a biological piece there. You know, that's only going to be part of the picture. We're going to see, and certainly, you know, and what makes me sad about that, the case that was just described, is that, A lot of times, a person's anger does alienate their social support network. And people who have real serious maladaptive anger problems, they tend to alienate people. They scare their kids. They scare their spouse. And what makes that particularly sad is a lot of times it ends up being kind of unknown to the culprit in this case, that they don't necessarily realize the negative effect their anger is having on their loved ones. It ends up damaging the relationship in a way that the person doesn't even realize.
So is there any health damage done to the person, him or herself, having so much anger or, for that matter, suppressing anger?
That's actually a really complicated question that I wouldn't say we have a definitive answer to. What I can tell you is that, first of all, I guess the part we do have a definitive answer to is that, yes, there is a relationship between anger and physical health problems. We see that, cardiovascular disorders in particular seem to be associated with anger. Like all research on medical disorders, it is complicated and confounded by all sorts of other factors. However, we know that's the case. What really gets complicated is there a better, what happens for someone who suppresses their anger, for example? And that is where it's hard to know, actually. I think the research is a little less clear about whether or not suppression, meaning kind of holding it in and not telling anyone, what consequences that has.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people would argue that, yes, there are consequences, but what they are, and are they worse than, the aggressive expression, I think is a little bit unclear.
We'll check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking about anger with Ryan Martin, anger researcher and chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. His piece on anger appeared last week on the Psychology Today website. It is linked to our program notes and to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says anger is a frequently misunderstood emotion. We confuse it with aggression and violence. Most of us think it is unhealthy, and we fail to recognize the times when anger has been positive. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 6:37 on this Monday, September the 26th. What about you? Have you ever experienced anger in a positive way? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Do you think of anger as a negative emotion, or do you see a benefit from it? We welcome your thoughts and questions as we talk with Ryan Martin, who is an anger researcher and chair of the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay. His piece on anger, 5 Things to Know About Anger, appeared last week on the Psychology Today website, and we have linked that to our website and the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And our next caller is Mark in Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
Hi. I just wanted to get your opinion. And it seems to be a very big difference if you're, say, a child or somebody who's not in the position of power. If you uncontrollably express anger, you're throwing a temper tantrum, or if you're a low-level worker, you may get reprimanded for that. But if you're in a position of power, say a CEO, or you're a coach like Bobby Knight, you're seen as an extremely strong leader, even if you do things that would otherwise seem childish and yell and express anger. And if you think that is productive, or if you think that's just possibly a misperception in society.
I think that's actually a really fascinating point, and it goes back to that idea that context is really important when it comes to how we respond and how we interpret things. And I think the caller is correct that the perception is very different depending on how much power the individual has. And I'll actually take the step further and say that some of the most appreciated characters on television right now are people who have, you know, who are kind of cruel and angry. For those fans out there who watch Glee, the one character, Jane Lynch's character, is, it's sort of chronically angry. People who watch Entourage might be familiar with Ari Gold's character. A lot of the media personalities are people who are kind of outwardly aggressive in their expression of anger. And I think it goes, you know, that people seem to appreciate that in those contexts, but not when it's someone who is kind of powerless or the worker who may get fired or the child who's having a temper tantrum.
Thank you very much, Mark, for the call. Our next caller is Diane in Milwaukee. Hello, Diane.
Hello. Wonderful to talk to you. It's my first time.
Well, thank you for calling. Yes, go ahead, Diane.
I have found, because I, for one thing, am a little bit of a victim of obsessive-compulsive disorder, I understand the power of the mind and how something can be perpetuated when you continually feed it with your thoughts. And I think, seemed to me years ago, the theory was, well, the more you expressed your anger and screamed and yelled and pounded and everything, that was good. You were venting. But I think now the theory is, at least I know myself, that to express it is a good thing in an appropriate way. But then, admit your anger. Mm-hmm. You're angry. But then once you've dealt with that, it's very difficult to do, but it is important, I think, to resist rethinking it. Because you can maybe think you're over it, and then 3 hours later you can think about it, and you get mad all over again. And I think for me as a person of faith, I do this through prayer and giving it up. And when I feel the urge to think about what made me angry, I just, I ask for strength to resist it. And
yeah.
Finally it does dissipate. And I just want to say one more thing, that once it dissipates, you're in a much better position than to deal gently and kindly and effectively with a certain problem than when you're in a state of anger, which you may do things that aren't effective. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I think what's tough to get at, and I don't disagree with Carl, I think what's tough to get at is when we are when we're ignoring it, basically, and that might not be healthy. It's just the idea that, okay, I'm mad about something, but I'm just going to push it away, right? That might not be healthy. But at the same time, the opposite isn't healthy either, and I will be the first to admit I have a bad habit of what we call ruminating, right? When something makes us upset, just thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And that isn't necessarily healthy either. I think that to me, that speaks to the need to try and do something about it, that if you're really thinking about this too much, and just going on and on and on, to try and solve whatever problem is creating it. And that's maybe one of the best ways to let it go. There are times when you can't do anything about it, maybe because you don't have the power to fix it, maybe because, for a variety of reasons. And so in those cases, I think the caller is absolutely correct that, you know, you need to find a way to let go of that, because just continuing to think about it isn't necessarily going to be helpful.
And what about the comment that we should admit our anger, and try to figure out the appropriate response?
I think it's a great point. I think people, prior to working in academics, I did some therapy work, and I have also found that many clients were reluctant to admit their anger, that it was, and part of it, I think, was that they weren't necessarily doing the yelling and screaming and things like that, so they didn't necessarily see it. Tended to think, like a lot of people do, that, well, anger is aggression, that it's yelling, it's screaming, it's hitting people and things like that. I don't do those things, so I must not be angry. But that said, people do seem reluctant to kind of fess up to this emotion.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a handle on, sometimes our anger can be almost perpetual, perhaps, if, let's say, we feel we were wronged by and hurt by an abusive parent. That's an anger that just kind of stays with you for
right.
forever. It's not like I'm just angry because that motorist cut me off in traffic.
Yeah, there are times when the anger isn't about a specific kind of current situation that's happening, but something that's happened in the past or continues to happen because of a, you know, a long-standing situation. And that is, you know, that is going to be different for certain, that partially because you have the relationship, or you may have that relationship with that person, and that relationship is that sort of forever changed because of that, of how things, I guess, went down.
Yeah. Can the way we deal with or show anger rub off on other people, in other words, our kids?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that one of the things that we see is that, and this is true of all emotions, that kids tend to express a lot of the same or similar emotions as their parents. And, you know, that kids whose parents express positive emotions tend to express positive emotions and vice versa. And how we interact with people is something our kids are watching and modeling, and they'll see that too.
Our next caller is Terry in Whitefish Bay. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Jean.
It's Joy, but go ahead, Terry.
I'm on a cell phone. I hope you can hear me. I just wanted to share what I share with high school students I teach to deal with their emotions. I've come down to a few simple formulas, and one I use for dealing with emotions, especially negative emotions, but all emotions, is to claim it, frame it, tame it. That if you don't claim those emotions, especially the ugly ones like anger, you don't deal with them properly. They hide and fester and boil and surface in ugly ways. In framing it, of course, you do step back and analyze it, possibly even with professional help, and taming is to appropriately vent it. And then, of course, the conflict resolution formula fits in there with I feel because I need, when you do need to deal with someone. An effective method we found through a cardiologist who taught me this, Dr. Bruce Wilson, is heart math, and we use the tools to immediately handle emotions. And then the final thing I wanted to segue on to your comment about failing to deal with anger appropriately is like the famous saying I like to teach them about holding on to anger and failing to forgive is like drinking poison and expecting the other guy to die.
Oh, yeah. No, that's claim it, frame it, tame it. That's easy to remember, Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I think, first of all, just a comment about the at the end. You know, there is, and I'm not a forgiveness expert. However, there is all sorts of evidence that that forgiveness is a very healthy thing to do, and that it has very real physical and psychological health benefits. So, I mean, I think the caller is absolutely right on that, and I think that her description of claiming the emotion and so forth is makes sense. I do want to one thing I guess I'd like to be careful of though is we do tend to frame emotions as sort of positives or negatives. You know, that this idea that we consider anger or fear or sadness kind of ugly emotions or unhealthy emotions, and maybe joy or surprise as positive ones. I tend to not think about them that way. I tend to think of them as being just, you know, I guess in my mind, emotions just are. It's something we experience, and it's something that that gives us information, tells us something about our experience in the world. And so I think, you know, I see them as motivators. And the same way, you know, as I put in the article, the same way hunger encourages us to eat and thirst encourages us to drink, you know, anger encourages us to confront injustice. And that isn't, there's nothing bad about that. However, it can be bad depending on what we do with it and how we handle it.
Yeah. I don't know, attending a protest is one thing, or if you're going to, you know, somehow harm someone, that's not a good thing.
Right, exactly. You know, I think that, you know, when you're frustrated or angry about something, you know, attending a protest or writing your congressman or things like that, that those are absolutely very, very healthy, reasonable, responsible things to do. However, taking it the next step and being, you know, cruel to people or hounding people or things like that, you know, that's when you've crossed a line.
Yeah. Let's see. Carlene in Brooklyn is with us now. Hello, Carlene.
Hi there. I'm also a teacher, and only of middle school students rather than high school students. And it's been my experience that middle school students are often frustrated by their lack of control at a time when they feel like they should have more control, or they certainly want more control over what's happening with their lives. And a lot of that shows up in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And that anger is often focused on their classmates or on their teachers. And I would just wonder if you have suggestions for simple things. Certainly, sometimes there's opportunities to process with a child separately, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of loss of learning time due to inappropriate handling of frustration that turns to anger. So I just wonder if the professor has some suggestions for classroom teachers.
Oh, I wish I did. You know, I think the caller is absolutely correct that first of all, we have the powerlessness associated with that age. I also think part of what's going on, too, is that the impulse control at that age is really lacking. And a lot of times what we see is, and we think of as anger problems, I think of as being impulse control problems, that it's not just that the person's angry, but it's that they lack the capacity to control their angry impulse. And that, to me, is where, to try and focus some of the attention is, you know, it's okay that you're mad, but let's talk about what we can do when you're angry. And are there ways that you can best express that? In addition to a lot of the kind of reframing and that thing that we've been talking about, there's also relaxation approaches that tend to work. The deep breathing exercises and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is in our final moment here, Dr. Martin? What's the takeaway? If we can only remember one of the five things, what should it be?
I think for me, it is. I would say that it is number three there. That anger is not inherently bad. In my mind, and this is true of all emotions, but in my mind, it is. Pay attention to the emotions that you're experiencing. Think about what they mean and why you're experiencing them. And I think if you do that, you're going to have a better handle on what to do with that experience, what to do next.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ryan Martin, anger researcher, chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. His piece on anger, Five Things to Know About Anger, was on the Psychology Today website last week. We've linked it to our website, wpr.org/joy, and the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We will have our Monday morning wake-up call in just a moment. First, our weather forecast. We've had quite a bit of rain this morning in southern Wisconsin, but it should be, for the most part, a cloudy day, breaking up somewhat this afternoon, breezy with a chance of showers and isolated storms continuing. High temperatures will be in the upper 50s to mid-60s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. That percolator song means it's time to wake up and smell the coffee. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is about 7 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, September the 26th, and it's time for the Monday Morning Wake-Up Call. Every Monday at this time, we find a guest, or a guest finds us, to issue a wake-up call on a topic, and today that topic is structurally deficient bridges in Wisconsin. And issuing today's wake-up call is Bruce Spate, the director of the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group, or WISPRG. Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a lot of bad bridges in Wisconsin?
We do, unfortunately. Yeah, actually 1 in 12 of our bridges is structurally deficient. So we have a lot of work to do to make sure that the health and safety of our bridges is up to par.
Well, are we going to possibly get these bridges fixed under President Obama's jobs plan?
Well, we hoped so. I mean, certainly his announcement was a step in the right direction, but I think first it's important to recognize that the fact that he even has to stand up and say we need to fix it first is evidence of the problem that, you know, for decades we've neglected basic repair and maintenance of our infrastructure while continuing to build more and more. And that's really a double whammy for taxpayers, because not only do we have to pay for the cost of maintaining more infrastructure, but we're neglecting repairing infrastructure that we have, which once we get around to it, ends up costing us more. So, so it is time for a wake-up call, and we do need to change our priorities. This is a chronic problem that we need to fix. It's time to repair our infrastructure before building more.
Yeah. So, how do we fix that problem?
Well, we really need to fix it on both a state and a federal level. And one way we can do it is to put in statute and ensure that before we are adding to our infrastructure, we're taking care of what we've got. And so we're calling on both state leaders, but also our federal leaders to do just that, put in place strong fix-it-first policy, which ensures that we are going to look out for what we've got before building more. And as we discussed a few months ago on your program, Joy, our most recently passed a budget did not take us in that direction, where we increased the budget for major highway projects by 13% and cut the budget for repair and maintenance by 10%. So we've got a lot of work to do, and it comes down to urging, calling on our state and federal leaders to get their priorities straight and change the way we do things.
Well, Bruce, why do you suppose it is that we would have 1 in 12 bridges in Wisconsin being structurally deficient, presumably, you know, dangerous in some respects, yet we're not fixing them and we instead are building new highways?
Well, I think that one. Well, I think there are a couple things at play. One is that, you know, we love new things, and so whether it's politicians or just the general public, you know, it's much more appealing to build something new than to repair something we've already got, in terms of holding a ribbon cutting ceremony or a press conference. So I think that's part of it. It's just attention there. But I think really the other bigger issue is that, you know, the highway lobby, the road builders, are using their money and influence to advocate for the projects that that make them more money. And more often than not, that's not repair, but instead a new highway project or a new bridge. So there's also that political tension at play. And, you know, again, it comes down to taxpayers, to citizens. We need to rise up and urge our leaders to change those priorities and do what's in the public interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the in this report that you released last week, Fixing It First, you rank, I guess, or at least list all of the bridges in Wisconsin that are structurally deficient. Are there any that you'd even like to highlight right now as being, you know, as counties or areas that have a lot of them?
Well, yeah, what we did is a county-by-county breakdown, looking at the percentage of bridges in each county that are structurally deficient. And to be clear, a structurally deficient bridge is a bridge that needs attention, just so listeners aren't unnecessarily concerned. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. it's going to collapse immediately. It just means that it needs attention. In some cases, though, it very likely is a bridge that is unsafe. So we looked at the percentage by county of bridges that are structurally deficient, and I think it's alarming that in Milwaukee and Dane County, our two most populous counties, that 10% of the bridges are structurally deficient. And we have, you know, counties that have more than 20% of their bridges that are structurally deficient, so more than 1 in 5 in Langlade County. So, you know, we have problems almost everywhere in the state, you know, which is, again, just evidence that our public policy is not really in the public interest right now, where, you know, we're neglecting these basic needs. And or, you know, as we say, I think a good analogy is, you know, even a growing family wouldn't put a room on a new home without fixing a leaky roof. Mm-hmm. And that's really how we've approached our transportation policy for decades, is we keep adding on new rooms.
Got it.
And
I want to thank you for issuing this morning's wake-up call.
Sure.
Bruce Bate is the director of the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group.